It's the Burt Cohen Show. Can the dream be had for some people and not others? Well, it's kind of an American tradition that some people get really wealthy and everybody else is kind of on their own. Let's see here. I believe we have our guests Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese on the line. Are you there?
Yes, we are, Bert.
Thanks for having us on.
Income inequality. How important is that to America? Do people really care? Do they get it? Is it resonating? I mean, lately, even the certainly not liberal, certainly not left-leaning Barack Obama has said that income inequality is, quote, the defining challenge of our times, unquote. Pope Francis said that, quote, inequality is the root of social ills. Well, let's see what they really mean by that and if something is going to happen about that. Our guests today are Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese. And in the article they wrote together, and what publication was it originally in?
Alternate.
Alternate. Yeah. Oh, yes, of course, Alternate. In the article, you point out that the Economic Policy Institute published a report recently which concluded, quote, from 1979 to 2011, not that much time, the average income of the bottom 99% of U.S. taxpayers grew by just under 19%. So we got 99%, and all that period of time, it grows by 19%. The average income of the top 1% grew over 10 times as much, by 200.5%. Now, there's always been some income disparity. The article goes on, if over the last three decades, the wealth of the nation's very richest 1% has grown 10 times that of the nation's grown 10 times that over the average worker, and over that time period, the same tiny elite has captured more than half of the entire income increases, leaving the bottom 99% to divide the remaining gains, unquote. My sense is that this, I'm not sure how much this is resonating. We've always, in America, lionized, almost worshipped the very wealthy. People gather around the wealthiest thinking, oh, there's some kind of royalty. They're doing something right. If we hang around them, maybe some of that will rub off on us. People like to spend a lot of money and show off their wealth. Here, where the show is coming from, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a number of years ago, there was a guy named Dennis Kozlowski, who was exceedingly wealthy, worth something like, way back then, $300 million. And people were fawning all over him. I think he's out of jail now. He went to jail for a long time. He did something bad. And so now, you know, I don't know. What is wrong with Americans being very rich? I mean, if they made a lot of money, so what? Isn't that part of the American dream? Margaret and Kevin, take over.
You want to go first, Margaret, or should I?
Why don't you go first?
Well, you know, while there is that strain in the United States of people who worship the wealthy, I really think that's changing. First off, a lot of that is generated by the corporate media that includes the big publishing houses that try to highlight these people, make them into heroes. But I see a lot of pushback on that now. A lot of people are kind of disgusted by that kind of hoarding of wealth and the gaudy display of wealth. So I'm not convinced that that really is where most people are. I'd love to see some polls on that. It's often surprising when you look at polls where the American public is, because you look at the corporate media, mass media, you really get a different impression of a right-wing country when the polls actually show a left-of-center country. So it's hard to often tell the truth on those issues.
Well,
and there's nothing wrong with people making money.
Right.
But throughout the best times in our history, which I think in the post-World War II era up until probably President Reagan, that time period, we really saw a very different approach to dealing with extreme wealth. And that was to recognize that the people who make over-the-top wealth, way more than they need, way more than even the most wealthy people need, were taxed pretty heavily because we recognize that the wealth of these people came from the common space, the commons that we all contribute to, and that's not only obvious things like our infrastructure, but the role of workers in creating wealth. It's also things like our intellectual history, our technological history. Those developments and developments we're seeing worked on today create tremendous wealth for people who can take advantage of them. Someone like Bill Gates, yes, or Warren Buffett would not be who they are in a society that did not have the same technology, did not have the same advancements on the intellectual front that we have in the United States because of generations of work. So by recognizing that that wealth comes from all of us, we have a whole different approach to really building the society. Now, I'm not saying there can't be differences in wealth, but it's gotten to be so extreme where, CEOs are making hundreds of, $400 to $500 of what their average worker makes. So it's gotten way out of the ballpark of fairness. And what's interesting about this time right now is this is an issue, the wealth divide, that has been bubbling for really more than a decade. People have been aware of it and writing about it. It really bubbled over in a big way with the Occupy movement that put the issue on the agenda. Now, as you noted, the Pope and President Obama even talking about it. And so an issue that was not on the agenda is now on the agenda. And we're seeing protests around the country for minimum wage increases so that all workers make a wage they can live on, get above this poverty level workforce. And people are seeing that they can demand this and make progress on this. And we're seeing progress being made when there are votes. We've seen expansion of minimum wages increasing. So I do think it's actually resonating with people. I see people organizing around it, mobilizing around it, and acting on it. And I said at the top of the government, people are forced to even talk about it now. And we've just begun, by the way. This is just the beginning of making a real national consensus that we have to deal with this wealth divide. But it's beginning in a very strong way.
I would agree with what Kevin says. I think that the kind of celebrity culture that we have is really serving as a distraction to, it's not surprising that the corporate media is pushing this type of message because it distracts people from talking about the real issues that they're facing in their daily lives. I think the problem with the way that wealth is being created now is that it's being done at the expense of the rest of the population. So some economists call it predatory capitalism. What we see is corporations that exploit our resources. They exploit communities by poisoning them, by setting up factories close to where people live or go to school that release toxins without regard for the health of the local community. They take whatever means they can to reduce wages and the rights of workers. And so this is really an unjust way to create wealth, and then they take that wealth and they use it to wield political influence to further their wealth at the expense of people's lives. I mean, we see it with the health law that was put through, right, and how the insurance industry lobbied to make that really protect their profits, and we're now seeing the greatest transfer of public dollars to a private industry, the health insurance mm-hmm. industry, through the health law. And at the other end, patients are not going to be able to afford the health care that they need. So it's just being done in a very exploitative and destructive fashion.
Well, there's an awful lot that you said there that calls out for a lot more discussion. I'm going to try to take it one by one. Kevin, you talked about that it reminded me of something that I believe it was candidate Obama saying something about, well, you didn't do that by yourself. You didn't make right. that by yourself. And we all know the tremendous flack he got for that. I think that it probably did him and the issue probably, I don't know if it did more harm than good, but the fact that Bill Gates couldn't have made his billions without the internet already being there. You know, we need an infrastructure, the internet infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, the schools, a safe environment. But I'm not sure people get that. He took so much flack for that. Have we moved since then?
That's a good example, I think, of manipulation, because it really wasn't that much flack. It was a very small number of people whose voices were exaggerated by the corporate media to make it sound like a big wave of opposition. But I doubt that most Americans feel that way. I just don't believe it. I think it's important for us to turn off the corporate media and build our own media. That may be the biggest area of change that we need to work on, is creating a independent and citizens media so that our voice can be heard. Now, the corporate media, luckily, is because it's so over the top, like the example you give, has lost credibility. Only one out of four Americans, according to recent Gallup polls, actually believe the corporate media tells them the whole story.
Interesting.
That's the lowest it's ever been. The numbers are even lower for members of Congress who are essentially propaganda politicians who put out a lot of nonsense, and most Americans see that. And so I just think that we have a very out-of-touch media and out-of-touch political class. I don't believe there was a lot of flack to that, and unfortunately, those voices that are really representative of the American viewpoint aren't heard. But I suspect most Americans who believe, like Warren Buffett says, if, you know, he was born in Africa, he'd probably have been somebody's dinner rather than a billionaire, because he's not apt to do well in that environment. His skills are more in investing in the big finance economy, which wouldn't exist if not for the commons that created it.
Yeah, that's you've talked about a lot of truths there. I think about through the years the various things that the media has done to look balanced. I mean, you can have a rally with, you know, 5,000 people saying one thing, and if there's three people on the other side, what voices does the corporate media go for?
Exactly. Well, corporate media goes for what's consistent with its owner's message.
Absolutely.
And the owners are a handful of mega corporations. And so when the Tea Party puts out a message that's consistent with the corporate agenda, i.e. less taxes on corporations, less regulation, and they're a tiny group, they'll have Tea Party protests with more media than Tea Party members. But when the Occupy puts out a message that's consistent with the American view, challenging the big finance economy, challenging big finance capitalism, questioning the conglomeration of media, the media won't show up because they don't want that reported. When they do show up, they'll try to confuse people, saying that, what does it stand for? What are they trying to say when they occupy Wall Street, as if it's not obvious? And so I think your listeners are good to listen to shows like this, and I hope that's a sign that they're not listening to shows that, you know, give us misinformation on Ukraine, on Venezuela, on the economy, on the environment. There's so much more misinformation in the media. It's really a very, very sophisticated propaganda tool, and we are subjected to that. And I think more and more Americans are breaking from it and understand they can't trust the corporate media.
I think you're right, Kevin. I get the sense that people are certainly not trusting Congress. I think that I saw some poll that said that cockroaches are more popular than Congress. Seriously, and they don't. But there's some kind of there's an anger, there's a mistrust, and it's not focused right now. The Tea Party has been able to suck up some of that anger, misdirected, I think, and I suspect you guys agree. But there is something there, and people are looking for some way to gather the energy. And you mentioned Occupy Wall Street back in 2011. You know, they were all over the news. And one of the things that the corporate media was saying, well, what's the message? What are they trying to do? I think people got it. You ask anybody, 99% versus 1%, they get it. Now, is that accomplished everything they sought to do? Obviously not. But the fact that that's so thoroughly in our consciousness, I think that's a big deal. What are the signs, Kevin and Margaret, that the consciousness really has been raised? What's the evidence that the Occupy Wall Street movement had a fair amount of success?
Well, we, as we've written in other articles, we found that the Occupy movement actually did exactly what it needed to do. If you look at, you know, there's an activist who died in 2002 named Bill Moyer. He was a civil rights activist and anti-nuclear activist, and he wrote the 8 stages of a successful social movement, and the 4th stage is when something that's a problem in the society has been bubbling below the surface for a while suddenly comes to a head, and it's called the takeoff phase, where you see a protest suddenly mirrored all around the country, and that's what Occupy was. The wealth inequality and the corruption of our, you know, political system by big finance was the issue bubbling below the surface, and Occupy Wall Street brought that to a head. Kevin and I were participants in organizing the occupation of Freedom Plaza and stayed down there for several months. And it was very clear that people who walked through the plaza and came to visit us knew why we were there and supported what we were doing, because they were experiencing the wealth inequality and the corruption in their daily lives. And if you, you know, and there are studies now that look at kind of what's happened to the public discourse since Occupy, the Occupy movement began, and it's clear that there's much more discussion of wealth inequality, as you cited in the introduction, bubbling up even to forcing President Obama to say something about it, although we don't expect him to actually do anything substantive about it. And so we see continuing activism, but it's more kind of diverse, broad, you know, throughout the country on a broad variety of issues. But all of this work that's being done to stop foreclosures, to protest college debt, student debt, for health care, for jobs, all of this work is part of a broader movement for social, economic, and environmental justice.
It is. You know, Margaret mentioned that the Occupy encampments were stage four of the eight stages of successful social movement. Stage five, after the takeoff, is the landing, where people will say the movement failed, it accomplished nothing, it disappeared. But in fact, it hasn't disappeared. It's in an evolution stage. It's changing. And it accomplished a great deal by putting a new issue on the agenda. The stage we're currently in right now, stage six, which precedes the stage seven, which is success, stage six is a stage of building national consensus. And so when you see around the country 1,500 protests against Walmart, when you see in state after state after state protests against fast food workers' pay, when you see all up and down the Keystone Pipeline, whether it's ranchers or Native Americans or climate justice activists protesting the KXL pipeline and other pipelines and other forms of extreme energy extraction, that's part of the building of national consensus. And so we're actually following the very organic process that all successful social movements follow. We had this long time period before the takeoff when, this, for example, our article, we wrote that article this week because it was the fifth year anniversary of one of the key books about the wealth divide. What was it called, Margaret? The Spirit Level, which did an incredible job of documenting how the wealth divide affects almost every aspect of our life in a negative way. From not only the obvious things like poverty and homelessness, but health care, health outcomes, homicide, suicide, alcoholism, drug addiction, distrust of neighbors. I mean, it just went through graph after graph showing how the wealth divide has put us in this terrible situation in relation to all these incredible parts of our culture. So it was a long time coming to build up to the Occupy. The Occupy was a nationwide takeoff. Then we have the end of the encampment phase, and now in a new phase, which is one that's really critical, which is developing national consensus on two things. First, that the problem exists and that we need to do something about it. And secondly, on solutions to the problem, which we're also seeing develop now around the country with people working toward creating a new economy.
Interesting. I'm talking, Bert Cohen here with Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese about an article on the wealth divide, that it's starting to shake things up. You know, that's one other thing that I think it's accurate to say about most Americans is that, you know, we more than citizens, which takes time and patience and actual participation, we tend to be consumers and we want instant solutions. And with the Occupy Wall Street thing, there was no instant solution. But the reality is that you're talking about, I mean, we have some understanding of how history works. It doesn't happen instantly.
That's right.
But it is happening. It absolutely is happening. It's bubbling through. And one of the things you mentioned is the healthcare situation right now. I had my own example just this morning looking at my mail, a bill for medical care. The company that I insure with, well, they changed it. Not only did the rates go up, of course, the rates went up, but now all of a sudden there's a large deductible. That was never there before. I think the reason I bring it up, I mean, I'm angry about it, of course. I think people are starting to realize, hey, you know what? It's not so much Obamacare that's messing things up. I mean, could it have been better? Yes, a lot better. But the fact that the hands of the insurance industry were in it so deeply and thoroughly, it's the incredibly greedy insurance industry. I see a real shift there. People are buying bad Obamacare less and less and buying, hey, wait a minute, it's the greed of the insurance industry even more. And one of the things you talked about, among many things, is the movement by fast food workers and people who get, you know, really lousy pay, who work really hard and are just not able to keep up and are living in poverty, working full time and still living in poverty. It just seems wrong. Now, I wonder about the focus on raising the minimum wage. I'm concerned that many people, you know, it's so easy to set Americans apart from one another, to divide and conquer, that many people might not connect with low-income people on this, and that a large part of the national reaction might be, oh, this would just make everything more expensive. You know, if you have to pay people a higher minimum wage, they would just raise prices. I'm not sure how well that's going to connect. What's your experience, Margaret and Kevin?
Well, I think, you know, there have already been studies done to show that that actually doesn't happen, and that when you take people who are earning such low incomes, they're making daily decisions about how can they get to work, can they afford gas, what can they buy in terms of food, can they afford to buy the medications they need, clothing, household items, you know, heaven forbid that they actually go out and do something fun, like go to a movie or something. So when you raise that wage, people have a real need to spend it on basic necessities, and so you start to stimulate the economy just by raising to a minimum wage. So I think that's an important step that I hope, you know, that the pressure that's been exerted will create, but it's not a solution to the problem. Even the amount of money that they're talking about raising the minimum wage to is completely out of step with what the minimum wage should be if we were actually keeping up with inflation, and what a living wage in today's economy is when you look at the fact that since 1970, the cost of health care and education and food and other basic needs have risen multiple times. There was a recent study by the Congressional Research Service that showed what we consider to be the minimum poverty level is based on really old data from the 1950s, and that if we actually updated it, we would raise that level three times what it currently is. And so that's what, you know, a lot of the policies are based on, this very outdated poverty level. And the study showed, or the article showed, that 50% of people in the United States are in such great debt that they have actually zero wealth.
50%?
50%.
Zero wealth because of their debt, and that 47% are low or poverty income people. So it's really essential that we start to do something to open that valve and meet their needs. But those are not lasting solutions. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the problem is predatory capitalism, and so the solutions are a new system, a new economy, and that's what's really exciting, is there's so much energy around building the new economy.
Well, I definitely want to make sure we talk about that in this 55 minutes here, what we can do. And, you know, you mentioned 50%, and then you said the magic number, 47%. Of course, that makes us think of Mitt Romney disregarding the 47%. And thank goodness that audio appeared. But my sense is that most politicians, mainly Republicans, but also Democrats, figure, you know, people without money don't feel like they're part of the system, like they have a stake in it. The system doesn't care about them. And I think it's true, exceedingly regrettable, that the people in lower income brackets tend to not vote. They think, well, nothing's going to happen. We're totally powerless, that 47%. And isn't that the case, though? I mean, is this going to get low-income people to think that, wow, I can actually do something here, I can actually make a change? I'm not sure I see that yet.
Well, you know, it's very challenging because the system wants to tell you you're powerless.
Absolutely.
And so we're told we have no power all the time. And so part of our job is to show people that, in fact, we do have power, that we can change things. And we can point to multiple victories that we've had in the growing popular movement for social, economic, and environmental justice. We've had successes, not only changing the topic and putting the wealth divide on the agenda, but actually stopping the government, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have made us all poorer, literally, made 90% of Americans poorer, has been stalled, if not stopped, in Congress. The effort by President Obama, I think he tried four now, maybe five times, to cut Social Security,
yes,
has been stopped by people saying no,
absolutely,
and stopping Congress from going in that direction. So we do have some power, and we can have even more power if more people mobilize. So we have to keep getting out those victories, and there are many examples. Those are just a few examples of victories that, that make a difference. But I think people are right when they look at the election system. The electoral system is a mirage. We live in what is called a managed democracy, where people have the right to vote, but the candidates are chosen for them,
right,
and neither candidate will make any kind of transformative change. They'll work within a very small box of options, marginal differences between Republicans and Democrats, and they both play to their own base with those differences. But in the end, when it comes to both the foreign policy based on empire and economy based on big finance capitalism, neither one of them is going to challenge those basic realities.
No.
Or a tax structure that's no longer a progressive tax structure. No, they're not changing that. They're all making those problems worse, in fact. And so I think people are right to look at elections as not the solution. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't participate in elections, but I think it's very important for us to realize that we have two corporate parties and that we need to actually be building an alternative, and we need to be building a more important than an electoral alternative, building a mass movement that is independent of the two parties, that is not limited by their corruption-driven agenda. Corruption, by that I mean the rule of money,
yes,
rather than the rule of people,
yes,
drives the agenda in Washington, D.C. So we can't be limited by that agenda. So we have to be independent of the two parties. And our goal needs to be to build a mass movement. And what I mean by mass movement is one that stands for what majorities of Americans stand for, which I think we already do, by the way.
Yes.
And second, that has activated a significant percentage of the population. Now, research shows, if you look at the last 100 years of resistance movements, both violent and nonviolent, violent, by the way, fails much more often than nonviolent. Nonviolent has twice the success rate,
oh, yes,
of a violent resistance movement. But if you look at nonviolent movements that succeeded, you find that if 3.5% of the population is mobilized in support of goals supported by the majority, that they have never lost. They have never lost in 100 years.
What was that percent?
3.5%.
3.5%.
Now, the Occupy movement was probably about 0.1%. It was about 350,000 people. So it was, even with that small amount, we still had the impact. I think the movement's actually grown since the encampment phase. There are,
sure,
more people involved.
Yeah.
Even though media isn't reported, it's actually gotten bigger. And so I think we're moving toward 1%. But if we get, a few percentage of the people active, we will have a big impact. And it's an impact that will shake the foundations and transform the direction of the country. And we need to go way beyond minimum wage, for example. And I do think, by the way, if you look at polls, a living wage is supported by a majority of Americans. People want to see the minimum wage go up. So that's,
yeah,
across the board, including Republicans, majorities support raising the minimum wage. So I don't think that that's an unpopular view. But I think we can go beyond that, because we're going through a new phase of a different kind of economy where technology did a lot of the work that people now do. We're,
yeah,
going to have more people than jobs. We already have 7 people for every job vacancy, so we're already in that stage.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to start talking about things like a guaranteed national income, probably in the range of $40,000 or $50,000 per person. And I'm very serious about that, because,
yes,
we have to figure out a way to get money into the economy, and that's going to require us to change the way money is made. Right now, we give that money to the banking community primarily through loans, but it's the Federal Reserve primarily by giving the banks money at very low cost, and then the banks loaning that money and creating more loans from those loans. And so we have this kind of banking power base for creating money. That should be really the role of government, creating money. And the way to get that money into the stream of the economy is to have a guaranteed national income. We could do that and have a very flourishing economy where people are not facing poverty and homelessness. We'll have enough funds to survive. And that will be that's what we need to move toward. And that's this discussion at the very early stage, once it's understood, I think it'll be very popular.
Well, it could be, and it's been tried before. A couple things there. One is class war. You know, the upper class, the top 1%, when this gets talked about, they say, class war, you guys are waging class war. And that, I think a lot of people who used to be in the middle class still feel that they're in the middle class, and they don't want to be part of the lower. I mean, you know, we've had far less class consciousness than many, many other countries. We've always thought that there's a great deal of flexibility, that people can move up. Are people still buying the class war argument, or has that changed enough?
Well, I think that the people at the lower end of the income spectrum have felt like they've been in a class war for a very long time, and they've been on the losing end of that war. And with the growing wealth divide, we are seeing a disappearance of the middle class, and pretty much everybody who's not in the upper wealthy group is vulnerable because of, you know, debt. You know, requires debt to really live in this society right now. So there's kind of, they're living a middle-class lifestyle, but it's based on debt that leaves them extremely vulnerable to financial ruin. But I think we do see much more of a discussion of class consciousness, and we need to see more of that, because the way that our society is structured, it's actually ingraining a class system. You know, it's codifying it into law, and we're seeing it in terms of our culture as well, where you see that, you know, some people get premium service and other people get regular or economy service, or you see that in our healthcare system, some people will get platinum health plans, other people will get bronze health plans, and we need to be having more debate about what does that actually mean, and are we okay with that, actually treating some people lesser than we treat others.
Yeah, less than. And it reminds me of the feudalist system that was 500 years ago, when that simply was the case. And there are people who, well, like the most obvious Koch brothers, who really want that. They truly believe government should serve the very, very few. They actually, they're you know, they don't even pretend any otherwise on that. They want the government to serve them. And I'm reminded of a reality that politics and protest are both necessary. Neither is sufficient. There has to be movement on the streets. I'm sure we're all in agreement on this. And that great phrase from Franklin Roosevelt, when he was meeting with A. Philip Randolph of the Pullman Porters Union, a largely, almost entirely black union, when they were asking for equality in pay. And Roosevelt, certainly no right winger, said, "I'm with you. I support you. Now go out there and make me do it." And that's where demonstrations, people out on the street, need to realize that has worked. What you say about, 3.5%, just making the news, raising the consciousness, that is absolutely necessary. Are there people in politics now? I mean, I do want to talk about solutions. I'm just wondering, you know, not every member of Congress, you know, deserves to wear a corporate logo on their suits and dresses. Most of them, yeah, but not all of them. Are there people who are genuinely talking about this who have, I mean, obviously Bernie Sanders is one, and a lot of people hope will be running for president in 2016. That's important. Also important is Congress. Is Congress, I mean, yes, they're ruled by money. They just go begging for money with the Koch brothers and others. But they also know in the final analysis, it has to be votes. The people's votes can trump the money. Are there people in Congress right now? I mean, we can't have heroes on, you know, the knight in shining armor coming to save us. That's not going to work. But are there good people out there that are getting the picture, getting the message that a populist campaign, you know, participating and talking about the wealth inequality can actually resonate? Or most of them are probably deathly scared of it. They don't want to make angry their benefactors.
Well, that's the point. I mean, the heroes in Congress are people who are actively trying to impact Congress. The reason why the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been stalled, maybe even stopped, is because there were tens of thousands of emails and phone calls to Congress at a critical time when they were considering whether or not to approve Fast Track, which essentially would have given Obama a blank check to approve any agreement he wanted without congressional oversight. And it was the tens of thousands of people that were the heroes who made those phone calls. The reason why the war in Syria was stopped, in part, was because of tens of thousands of Americans who said, no, we don't want a war with Syria. And so the reason why Social Security has not been cut is, again, because tens of thousands of Americans said, no, that's not going to happen. So I think those are the heroes. I mean, every member of Congress, unfortunately has to raise money to get reelected. And that is just the reality of our corrupt, fake democracy, where money rules and people are secondary.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, they do need votes.
They do.
So the more mobilized people are, the more we will have a Congress that responds to our interests.
Yeah.
So I don't like to put any member of Congress in the category of a hero. I don't see any. Even Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, in the end, has to vote and often has to stay in the Democratic caucus. And so he will make votes that I would disagree with. For example, he supported Obamacare. I don't think he should have.
Mm.
Obamacare was a disaster. It was. You mentioned the insurance industry is a problem. Well, Obamacare made the insurance industry stronger and more powerful in this corrupt healthcare system. So
yes,
I would have voted against Obamacare, and unfortunately Sanders didn't. In fact, neither did John Conyers. So look at the Progressive Caucus, which, you know, would you think would have the best members of Congress, and they have pretty safe districts, usually urban districts, but they are pretty powerless, the biggest caucus on the Hill, and they're powerless because they compromise with those who really have the power in Congress, which is the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans. And so it really is not for us to look to members of Congress as our heroes.
Right.
It's to us to look to each other as heroes for taking action and getting mobilized. Those are the people who really matter in our political system. Not who's elected. The elected are our representatives. We've got to force them to represent us.
Right. That seems... Go ahead.
If I could just add, I think it's really important to recognize that it's not about electing a certain individual into Congress or into the presidency that's going to actually bring real social change, because the system as it exists is very good at controlling. Even if you do bring someone in there who has great ideas, they're not going to have any success in really implementing those ideas, maybe on a few small things. You know, that's where it's useful, is that, you know, within the current system, sometimes with massive pressure, we can get small changes. But to get the real change that we need to change the system is going to take more than that. And that's, the systems do exactly what they're designed to do.
Hmm.
So the system that we live in right now is showing the same outcomes. You know, showing the outcomes that it was designed to create. If we just try to tweak this current system, you know, maybe relieve it a little bit, as they did in the New Deal era, where they took some of the pressure off by giving, you know, some support to the public. But over time, that system again reverted back to exactly the same situation that we were in, you know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. We need to have a new system based on much more transparency, democracy, and participation, and that's what's starting to come up through the new economy and the new political processes that are starting to develop here and around the world.
And Margaret, you brought up a very interesting point, and you know, one thing that I have learned from history is that we hardly ever learn from history. But the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, it changed the Gilded Age. That was, I believe, that particular period was the most similar time, in that very few people had a tremendous amount of wealth and power. What got that to change? I mean, along came a Teddy Roosevelt taking on the, he was a trust buster, but I don't really know exactly what happened there that made that change. We need something like that now.
Well, there was a movement. There was what was called the populist movement.
Right.
That began in the 1880s, and it was very focused on banks and foreclosures and depression in the economy, and people organized. And it was really an amazing organizing effort, because they didn't have cars and telephones. They had horses, and they had to talk word mouth to mouth and hold town hall meetings and educate each other by talking to each other. And so it was a mass movement, and it created an electoral party. The People's Party, the Populist Party, that elected people at the local level and challenged the two parties. And that's really what laid the groundwork. And then, of course, in the 1900s, you had a whole socialist movement that started to raise issues of equality and a fair economy and an economy that works for the people, not for the wealthy. And they also ran successful presidential candidates. And I use the word successful, not meaning they got elected,
right,
but that they were big enough to impact the outcome of the election.
Right.
They were not afraid of spoiling the election for either corporate party. And I think that was a mistake made after 2000, Ralph Nader's election. Many of the liberal intelligentsia blamed Nader when they should have looked at the Democratic Party and said, Al Gore, you ran a corporate campaign. You couldn't win your home state. You couldn't win Clinton's home state. You couldn't convince a majority of Democrats in Florida to vote for you. You lost this campaign because you ran a lousy campaign that did not focus on the people's necessities, but instead focused on the interests of your funders. And that's what should have happened. And we should have said, we're going to run again in 2004 and support Ralph Nader if he runs again in 2004, because we're going to continue to spoil the election for corporate Democrats. Until you change, that's what's going to happen. And that's been the history of how change has occurred, other than slavery. Slavery was the one time where third parties actually destroyed one of the parties. They destroyed the Whig Party, which was the Whigs and the Democrats, the two major parties, and there were a bunch of abolition parties that finally turned into the Republican Party. And President Lincoln was essentially a third-party candidate who was the most successful third-party candidate in history, getting into office with less than 40% of the vote, but still winning. But other than that example, the way that we've won is by having candidates who get electoral support for new issues and enough support to spoil the outcome for one of the two corporate parties, and then those corporate parties realize they don't want to be the Whigs.
Mm.
They want to, in fact, continue, and they adapt to the demands of the people by adopting one of their issues or their key issues. And that's what we have to do in the electoral sphere.
Yes,
I think much more important in the electoral sphere is developing a mass movement. That's really where the power comes from. And the electoral activity, the third party or alternative party activity that represents our views, will come from that mass movement. The mass movement is the most important thing.
Well, I'm enough of a traditional Democrat to believe that the Democratic Party is still up for grabs. Yes, I know the vast majority are corporate Democrats, but as Will Rogers said, I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat, and we can do it, I think, at the local level. And here's an opportunity right now for the grassroots, for the populist movement. 2014, I think Democrats would be foolish, just dumb, quite frankly, not to take the populist line and say, you know, who is it? Is it the 99% that we work for, or is it the 0.1% that we work for? My guess is most Democrats won't touch it because they're afraid of it. We have to keep that pressure going. If you just tuned into the Burke Cohen Show, our guests today are Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese. We're talking about the income inequality. Is it happening? Is it changing? Are we having some success with it? The argument is that, yeah, it is happening here. It's a great movement, and it's got to be done from the streets, from the ground up. And in your article, you guys go so far as to suggest consideration of, and it's been mentioned here today, of a guaranteed national income. Now, this, you know, is not talked about very much. It's pretty radical. And I remember the last leader to advocate for this was a fellow named George Wiley, who founded the National Welfare Rights Organization. And he died very mysteriously in 1973. And that's another story, I guess. But of course, funding for this would be a challenge. You have a suggestion, though, and if I may quote, one that should be considered is treating government funding of businesses as taxpayer investment so that the taxpayers benefit as the gross domestic product expands. Very interesting. Tell us about this.
Well, do you want to do that, Morgan, or should I?
No, go ahead.
Well, you know, the U.S. economy is an amazing economy. It grows incredibly. And a lot of that growth, it's going to happen again in the future because there's a lot of economic need to transform to a new energy economy, to put in place a different kind of transit system and land use system, to adapt to the realities of the environment that we're facing. And so there is going to be growth. And if we want to invest in that new economy, that money should be considered an investment. And so a certain percentage of the profits from that investment should revert to the taxpayers. Could you imagine if during the era of railroads or the Industrial Revolution or the Internet Revolution, all these areas of major growth where the government played a gigantic role in making that growth? The railroads were because the government put money
Absolutely.
And gave land
yep.
to the railroads.
Yep.
The same with the Industrial Revolution, same with the Internet Revolution. The government was very involved, gave a lot of money. People call it corporate welfare because we don't get any return out. We just give it to the corporation. Now, in Alaska, they've had something called the Alaska Permanent Trust since 1979 when the citizens voted for it. It was put in place in 1980, and since that time, a certain percentage of profits from oil found on public lands go into a fund, the Permanent Trust, and each year that fund gives a check to every Alaskan. And that check is about $1,500 to $2,000 a person, so a family of five could have about $10,000. Now, if we did that on a national scale with the needs we have right now for a new energy economy, and we started to invest in greening the economy and putting in place wind and solar and thermal and ocean energy, and there would be tremendous profits from that, and that money could then be put into a fund that was shared by all Americans. Looking at the way the economies grow, that would result in a pretty large amount of money over the next generation, a guaranteed national income. And also the guaranteed national income, which, by the way, was supported by the radical President Richard Nixon, the radical economist Milton Friedman. So it's not as radical as you think when these kind of right-wingers even supported in the past. But when you have a guaranteed national income, you don't need to have food stamps. You don't need to have support for housing for the poor, or for all sorts of poor people's programs, because suddenly these people have money to pay their own lives. And so you get rid of a lot of bureaucracy, you get a lot of expenses. So the combination of those two, turning corporate welfare into taxpayer investment and doing away with poverty and homelessness by giving guaranteed national income, results in, I think, a very affordable path that would really create, I think, a lot of freedom for Americans. And I think we'd see... Mm-hmm. A lot of creativity from people who right now are too busy trying to survive on poverty wages, working two jobs, and such. And we would see a lot of creativity that would actually create unpredictable growth in the economy.
What an idea, having our taxes used to build the economy and benefit us all and not just depend, you know, on the kindness of strangers. That's you mentioned Alaska. I believe it's North Dakota has a similar thing, that the oil revenue goes.
North Dakota has something similar. It's a public bank,
right?
Which is, I think, another important
absolutely
reform that's needed. I'd like to see every major city in every state have a public bank of its own, so that the Bank of Baltimore would hold all the money that the city of Baltimore has in property taxes, sales taxes, salaries and wages for the people who work for the city, held into an account and create our own bank so we can leverage that money for loans to community banks in order to build the community up. And that's what North Dakota has. And about two dozen states are considering public banks. No other state has really put it in place because they always get threats from Wall Street.
Yeah.
Wall Street threatens to cut their bond rating and you know, make it hard for them to get money from Wall Street. But there's no question in my mind that a public bank, which rather than serving the interests of shareholders and executives who make big bonuses and big profits, it serves the public interest. That's the mandate of a public bank, is to serve the public interest. That's how our money should be used, to do that. And then I think beyond that, beyond public banks, we need to have a whole other discussion about what to do with our central bank, the Federal Reserve, which essentially is a bank of bankers. If you look at the regional reserves, the stock is owned by all the big banks in the country. And so they essentially own the Federal Reserve. And while the Federal Reserve Chairman is appointed by the President, it's a private corporation. And so we need to recognize that we have a private corporation doing what the government's supposed to be able to do. Under the Constitution, the government can create money. Under the way we operate, the Federal Reserve creates money, gives it to the big banks who charge the government interest for money we could create. So it's an absurd system that puts us into debt. We'd much rather see a public central bank that was accountable and transparent to the public and that served the interest of the whole economy, not just the interest of bankers.
And it seems to me that the very fact, I take heart in how well Ron Paul did when he was talking. He was the only candidate talking about, I mean, I, of course, don't like his racism particularly, but at least he was talking about the Federal Reserve and the monetary system and making, you know, addressing this wealth divide. He was talking about it, and he resonated. So, I mean...
Yeah, not only that, he not only resonated, but Paul and Kucinich successfully passed through the House and ordered the Federal Reserve, and Bernie Sanders led the effort in the Senate to pass it, and there was actually an audit of a snapshot, not the kind of ongoing audit we should have, but an audit of a portion of time of the Federal Reserve, which uncovered a lot of interesting things, in particular how much money we are creating and giving to international outside the United States, how much of the money that's created, U.S. dollars that are created by the Federal Reserve go out of the country to foreign banks.
We have to keep that pressure up. And one other thing I wonder about in terms of raising money, a financial transactions tax. There's been a lot of talk about that. People like Chuck Collins, co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, and Bill Gates Sr. have been talking about this to address the, I mean, just, you know, people with wealth, addressing the inequality issue. A financial transactions tax, like 0.25 or 0.50% tax, I mean, that would raise a lot of money as well.
Would that raise a lot of money, but it would also have another effect, which would be to slow down kind of this very risky, microsecond trading that's going on right now in the country, and that puts us all at risk of another financial crash.
Hmm.
So it would both raise funds that could be used for public projects, but it would also reduce a little bit of the risk of the trading that's going on right now. Kevin, I think you wanted to comment.
Well, I'll say this is actually an old idea that goes back to Keynes. In the middle of the last century. It goes into Tobin, who's a Harvard economist, the Tobin tax. And we've actually looked at this in some detail, and if we do a micro tax, a tiny micro tax of a 0.1% on financial transactions, stocks, bonds, derivative trading, it would create enough new money that we could do away with the income tax on everybody up to $100,000. And so it's a gigantic amount of money that's out there, and that's one reason why you see the wealth divide the way it's gone, is because we have while we pay a tax on food, clothing, shelter, property, and so many other things, our cars, et cetera, the people who are in these big hedge funds and the big banks who are making money off of financial transactions are not taxed for those transactions. So it's a crazy system where the wealthy aren't taxed for how they make their money, but we're all taxed on not only how we make our money, but how we spend our money.
Well, there's obviously some great solutions out there, and there's been various different meetings, the People's First Grassroots Conference on Monetary Policy. If people want to go to your article on Alternet, it's there. There's a lot in there. And there's a lot to talk about here, the whole idea that many of the super wealthy have this odd addiction to making more and more and more, and it's kind of sick, actually. I don't know if they're getting help for that. They have so much money, they just have to make more. But I just want to ask, Margaret and Kevin, do you get that there's momentum, that people are seeing that this great concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands is, in fact, weakening our republic and replacing it with something, a plutocracy, government of, by, and for the very rich? Are people getting that? My sense is, the majority still blames the government and not the corporate rulers of the government. What do you guys think? Are people getting this?
Yeah, I think that I do think that the majority of people are getting it. I think that there's a minority that has a strong voice, which is blaming it on the government. But I think the majority of people do understand that it's the people with the money that are determining what the laws are. I mean, we see it even down to the local level. That the people in our community with the money are the ones who influence the policy decisions. And coming from a blue state, I just have to add that I would disagree with your comment earlier about electing more Democrats. We don't see that as a solution here in the state of Maryland, which has been solidly blue all the way down to the local level for a while. But
it has to be the right Democrats. I have to say there are some that are.
Well, it's not the problem right now. Is that it's the system that we're in.
True.
That there's such ability to control what our policymakers do that we're able to get some small wins, but we really have to change the system. I think Louis Brandeis said it very clearly, that you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both. So it's the fundamental catalyst to change in this country is to change the economy to a more democratized, participatory, and transparent economy. And that's the work that's happening all across the country. And that's what's going to reduce the wealth divide and shift political power.
Now, I'll just add as a concluding point
for
you.
Sure.
Again, don't buy the mass media. There is a lot of momentum on the side that we're talking about. If you look at our primary website, which is popularresistance.org, we cover what's happening in the movement. And there are people working in all sorts of areas on these issues every day. Thousands are doing it. You can get involved and get active. If you want to learn about the new economy that we're talking about, we have a website linked from popularresistance.org, but you can go to it directly. It's oureconomy.us. And on that, we review the development of the new economy and of the existing economy. So there are lots of ways for people to get involved, and people are getting involved. As I said, this movement is now larger than it was when the Occupy encampment phase ended.
Right.
You won't know that from the corporate media, but if you go to Popular Resistance, you can sign up for our daily news digest, and in your email every morning, you'll get a list of 15 to 20 articles with about a paragraph about each, showing you what's being done around the country by people actually trying to create a more just society and a more fair and equitable economy. So I think the momentum is on our side more than we realize, and that we have more power than we realize, and I hope that people will visit popularresistance.org and sign up for that daily digest.
I just did. I just did. Thank you very much. Very, very informative. I'm sure we'll talk again. Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese, thanks so much for being with us today and for the optimistic look on the future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
Bert.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can bring for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can make it on the chin, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht.
What?
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the go round, of that we both are sure. I'm being poor. Money, 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 money.
When you haven't any shoes on your feet, and your coats that is paper, and your look that
you can't get away.
When you're going to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you the love of a maw. What with hunger comes around at the window. At the window.
Who's that?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world. Money makes the world go around, the clinking, clanking sound of.
Money, 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 give a little, get a little money.